Hello, and welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. I'm Chuck Stanley, senior reporter with Infralogic, and I'll be speaking with Gary Durden today, partner and managing director with CRCIB, about the tax credit transfer market. Gary provides transaction management and advisory services for clients in the sustainable energy sector, including corporate M&A, capital raises, and structured finance solutions for wind and solar projects. Gary, thanks so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Chuck. Thank you for having me on the program today.
Thank you so much for joining us. As some of our listeners may know, the U.S. Treasury Department recently finalized rules that allow recipients of tax credits for things like renewable energy development under the Inflation Reduction Act to sell those credits to third-party investors to use against their tax liability. It's generally referred to as tax credit transferability. As we've reported at Infralogic, the tax credit market has grown rapidly since a regulatory framework was proposed last year. Gary, for listeners who may not be entirely familiar with tax credit transfers, can you give a brief overview of how the transfer market works and how it's evolving as a source of capital for the renewable energy sector?
Sure. Well, you know, it's pretty simple in concept. An owner of a project that generates tax credits can sell those credits to a buyer, which is different than it has been treated historically. Prior to the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, only an owner of the project could claim these tax credits. And so project owners typically don't have the tax liabilities that's needed to effectively utilize those credits. So they would have to bring in a partner and then disproportionately allocate items of taxable income and credits to that partner. And the partnerships that they formed were somewhat complicated, and the universe of potential buyers was limited. Now you can simply find a buyer who can, you know, sign a purchase and sale agreement and take those credits. The buyer will, you know, for every dollar of tax credit that they get, it reduces their tax liability by a dollar. So they will purchase the credits from a seller at a discount, say 90 cents on the dollar, and then utilize those credits to offset their tax liabilities. Now there's limitations on when the closing of that sale can take place. The sale can't happen any earlier than the year in which the credit is generated, and it can't happen any later than the tax filing date for the seller. A buyer who is credit worthy can provide a commitment to purchase the credits at any time prior to the project being placed in service. And so the seller of the credit can take that commitment and then get a loan against it. It's basically a bridge loan. I would also say that the market is evolving. It's very young right now, but it's rapidly evolving. Some of the things that we're seeing is the buyer universe is expanding. We're seeing more and more buyers come into the market. We're seeing the way in which these transactions are being executed is also evolving. You have bilateral transactions, which here at CRCIB, we mostly deal with. But there are some online exchanges in an attempt to simplify the process. Those are typically for smaller deals, you know, something less than, say, $5 to $10 million. But, you know, that is, you know, something that is continuing to evolve. Pricing is evolving. It's mostly driven by supply and demand, and there's some scarcity pricing that's involved. But we're seeing price move as we get through, as the market continues to evolve. And then finally, I'd say, you know, the terms under which you're selling these credits is evolving, especially around indemnification provisions related to any clawback or recapture of these tax credits.
Right. And just to give a sense of how important tax credit transferability is likely to be to the renewable energy sector in the coming years, a lot of people I've spoken with for Infralogic have said that without the provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act for tax credit transfers, the lion's share of incentive payments for renewable energy and other projects aimed at fighting climate change would be essentially stranded. Is that your view as well? And if so, can you explain why?
Yes, I agree with that. And the reason why is, you know, even prior to the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, wind and solar projects were the primary beneficiaries of these federal tax credits, and they struggled. Owners of those projects struggled to find tax equity. It's just a very constrained market. There's a handful of large banks that supply probably 60 to 80% of the total volume of tax equity deals that were done in every year prior to the Inflation Reduction Act being passed. So the market was somewhat limited. And now, fast forwarding to today, where the Inflation Reduction Act has been passed, it has not only renewed the tax credits for wind and solar projects, but it has expanded the tax credit to cover new technologies that previously did not qualify for the tax credit, such as carbon capture, renewable natural gas, standalone battery storage, and various green fuels that are now eligible for the tax credit. So that the market of potential projects that can qualify for tax credits has now been vastly expanded. And in addition to that, you have credits that there's a bonus credit that's available for certain qualifying projects. For example, if it's located in an area, what's called an energy community area or a low income area, it can qualify for bonuses of 10, 20, 30%. So because of that, the Inflation Reduction Act is going to potentially lead to many, many more projects coming online and generating many more federal tax credits. And so the owners of these projects are going to be seeking someone to help them monetize those credits. And if we were to rely solely on the pre-IRA tax equity market, which was about $20 billion of tax equity per year prior to the IRA, that would be a serious constraint. So opening up transferability brings in the ability to bring in new potential buyers, new participants in this market, and should greatly extend the universe of potential counterparties and therefore allow these projects to get built and come online. Otherwise, there just wouldn't have been a market to finance all of these projects, and all of these credits that were made available without transferability would likely have been stranded.
So it sounds like the amount of traditional tax equity that was in the market prior to the IRA was already sort of running up against its capacity, and this larger universe of new investors or tax credit buyers was really needed in order for developers of more traditional solar and wind projects, as well as some of these newer technologies, to be able to monetize their credits. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. Prior to the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, there are two technologies that were the primary beneficiaries of these federal tax credits, and that was wind and solar projects. The market was constrained for traditional tax equity. Project owners found it challenging to attract tax equity investors to invest in their projects. There was just too much demand and not enough supply of the tax equity product. And you know, prior to the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, the tax equity transaction volume each year was somewhere in the range of $18 to $20 billion. And we think that now with the passage of the IRA and the expansion of the availability of these credits to different technologies, as well as the introduction of the bonus tax credits, that the amount of deals that could get done would be double that $20 billion figure in the next couple of years alone, and potentially quadruple before the end of this decade. So without an alternative to traditional tax equity, a lot of those projects simply could not get built because they would not have the financing needed to fund the construction.
And I think something that you kind of alluded to in your earlier response was that although tax credit purchases don't require the high level of diligence, expertise, and transaction costs needed to execute a traditional tax equity deal, they're not a completely seamless kind of over-the-counter transaction. Can you talk a little bit about why that is and whether as time goes forward and the market matures, we might expect to see an increase in efficiency over time in these transactions?
That is correct. These transactions are not necessarily as seamless as, say, purchasing a company's stock on an exchange. The primary reason for that, and this is related more to the investment tax credit than the production tax credit, and the investment tax credit happens to be, at least currently, much more prevalent in the market. The primary reason for that is there is some risk that, you know, once you claim the investment tax credit, the IRS may come back and challenge you on the amount of the credit that you received. The amount of the credit that you receive is based on the cost to build the project, which can include implied developer fees related to, you know, the development work needed to get the project to construction phase and actually built. And the IRS has in the past challenged the amount of the developer fees that are imputed to that project, and therefore it affects the investment tax credit. There's also potential for the IRS to recapture the ITC. The ITC vests over a five-year period, and certain events that may occur during that five-year period could trigger a recapture by the IRS. You know, one simple one is if the project owner sells the project during that 5-year period, the unvested portion of the ITC could be recaptured by the IRS. But this could also apply to, for example, a foreclosure by a bank. If the bank has a lien on the project and they foreclose and take ownership of the project, that is similar to or akin to selling the project. You transferred ownership, and that could trigger a recapture. Another example would be there's some catastrophic failure of the project, and because of some natural catastrophe, say a earthquake or hurricane or violent hailstorm that damages solar panels. And if the project is not rebuilt, then there's some risk that the ITC could be recaptured. So there's a lot there. And so the buyer of these credits has that risk. They're the one who's going to be responsible for the IRS coming back and reducing or recapturing that credit. And so before they make their purchase, they are going to have to do some due diligence. You have to make sure that the project can be a viable operating project for that 5-year vesting period or recapture period. They're going to want to make sure that they have indemnifications from the buyer against any kind of recapture event. And those indemnifications need to be backstopped by a creditworthy entity. So maybe a parent guarantee. If the parent company is not creditworthy enough, there are insurance products that are available that can enhance the guarantee provided by the seller of the credits. And finally, there are certain financial structuring that you can put in place to allow the project owner to divest their interest in the project and, you know, minimize the risk of a recapture event. There's quite a bit of due diligence and structuring that may need to be done in order to effectively mitigate the risks associated with the purchase of the ITC.
And so you said a lot of those risks are more prevalent with projects claiming the investment tax credit. Presumably, if a project sponsor is claiming the production tax credit, which is the other sort of main avenue for claiming these tax credits, there's less risk of an IRS challenge or recapture just because the credit is directly linked to production of either energy or, in the case of an alternative technology, say the amount of hydrogen produced or the amount of carbon captured. Is that right?
For the production tax credit, the tax risk is lower than the investment tax credit. The risk that the production tax credit is reduced or reclaimed by the IRS is lower, but not zero. There could be challenges, for example, around when the project is considered to have been begun construction, and therefore whether the project can claim the production tax credit. But given we have a 10-year runway on the PTCs, I don't think that'll be an issue anytime soon. It would get become more of an issue as the PTC gets closer to the phase out date. So for PTCs, yeah, lower tax risk. There's production risk, of course. The project may not generate the amount of the required product, you know, the energy or the green hydrogen that was forecasted in the model that was used to close the transaction. But those deals, the PTC purchases, are typically structured where a payment comes in arrears. So you look back at how much was produced, and then, you know, you determine how many PTCs were produced, and then you purchase that. In that sense, the PTC buyer takes on much less risk. The primary challenge with the production tax credit is that the PTCs are earned over a 10-year time horizon. And most owners of projects who are looking to monetize that PTC stream will want to have someone who can provide a long-term commitment, you know, to purchase those PTCs over that full 10 years. And the universe of buyers who can actually do that is quite a bit smaller than the universe of buyers who can purchase a tax credit that, you know, they have some degree of certainty will be earned in the next year or maybe 2 years.
That certainly makes sense. One thing I'm also hearing a lot about is what's been described to me as a hybrid structure for tax credit transactions, where a tax equity investor will enter into a traditional tax equity partnership with a project sponsor, with the presumption from the outset of the deal that the tax equity investor will eventually sell a significant portion of the tax credits that they're eligible to through a deal with a third party. Can you tell us a little bit about the role hybrid deals have played in the transfer market so far?
Yes, actually, hybrid deals are becoming much more prevalent, especially among the larger, more traditional tax equity banks. Those institutions like the hybrid approach because they all have limited tax liabilities. Those tax liabilities may be large, but they are finite. And so there's really only so many tax credits they can monetize, so much accelerated depreciation that they can utilize before they run out of capacity. And so that limits the number of deals they can do. These banks are very relationship driven. So that means that they're saying no oftentimes to clients that they view as being very important. They want to make those clients happy or those customers happy. And so by being able to close a traditional tax equity transaction, but have the option of selling a portion of those credits to some other party, these banks are able to stretch their limited tax capacity and appetite across more deals, more clients, and therefore being a better counterparty to their important client base. Now, there is still a universe of smaller, less traditional tax equity investors who have been active prior to the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act. And these investors, from what I've seen so far at least, they're less interested in the hybrid structure. They like just doing regular tax equity deals. This is partly because they have more limited tax appetite, more limited tax liabilities, and they're interested in just, you know, doing a deal, reducing their tax liabilities, and then moving on. They're not very relationship focused. They're more transaction focused, and so less of a need to really try to do more deals. For them, doing a deal is more of a distraction than a main business line. I would make that distinction. But among the large tax equity investors, yes, I think the hybrid structure is becoming more and more prevalent. Now, sponsors like hybrid deals because A, it increases the supply of the tax equity product, so more deals can get done. They also like the hybrid deal versus the alternative of just doing a transfer. A simple transfer deal, the hybrid tax equity deal has really two advantages. One, the tax equity investor, while they're selling some or all of the tax credits, they're still taking the accelerated depreciation and monetizing that for that sponsor. So there's some economic benefit there that you would lose by just selling the tax credit. The other advantage, again, for investment tax credit projects is that by forming a partnership with a tax equity investor, you can effectuate a step up in the taxable basis and therefore the ITC eligible basis. And by doing that, you can increase the amount of the ITC and, you know, that resulting in better economics for the sponsor. I would say that in addition to the hybrid tax equity structure, we are also seeing a similar market develop among investors who are not tax focused. They're more of a cash driven or cash focused investors, oftentimes developing a preferred equity product that they can use to form a partnership with a project owner to effectuate a step up in basis and therefore increase the ITC amount. They're not taking a disproportionate share of accelerated depreciation, so the sponsor is missing the benefit of that economics, but it does allow the sponsor to get a step up in basis and therefore increase the ITC amount, which again is an advantage over just selling the ITC to an interested buyer. We are seeing a growth in that market as well. So there's really, I'd say, three different routes that a project owner can use to monetize their benefits. They can go hybrid tax equity route, they can go straight transfer deal, or they can utilize a preferred equity investor to help them get a step up in basis and sell the credits to another party after that.
And just to clarify for listeners who may not be as deeply embedded in this space, when you refer to a step up in basis, that refers to the fact that the tax credits are based on the valuation of a project rather than the amount of money that's necessarily invested in the project by the developer. And so in order to get that step up to the book value of the project, you need to have a transaction to place that valuation on the project. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. The investment tax credit or ITC is based on the value of the project. And without having a third party transaction take place, without having some type of a sale transaction take place, you're not able to effectuate that step up or have a basis for that step up in value. And so it's important to have some type of transaction take place, even if you're selling just a minority stake in the project. you need some type of transaction to allow that increase in value and therefore increase in the ITC. For the production tax credit, this is a non-issue. Production tax credits are just based on the amount of product that the project generates. And so this formation of a partnership is of less interest to a PTC project owner than an ITC project owner.
Right. And going back to what you were saying about sort of the larger traditional tax equity investors really liking these hybrid deals, that makes sense to me. They're able to sort of benefit from their expertise in this space, but then spin off these tax credits and kind of replenish their tax capacity to go on and do more deals. From the project side, are the hybrid deals predominantly being utilized by larger project sponsors, larger portfolios of projects, or are smaller developers able to get in on this sort of deal as well?
Yes. So for the tax equity hybrid deals where your counterparty is a large traditional tax equity investor, I would say that you're still more likely, those counterparties are more likely to do a transaction with a larger, more well-established sponsor who has a good track record and a strong pipeline because of their product that they offer, their experience in underwriting these transactions and doing these investments. They just have the track record, the credibility to get deals done. And they can be somewhat more picky and choosy about with whom they choose to do business. But smaller developers with less of a track record do have the ability to do partnerships with preferred equity investors. The preferred equity investor market, I think, is small, but it's growing. And with more participants coming into the market, there's more competition to find sponsors with whom to do deals. And so there may be more opportunity to do these transactions. Also, the larger investors tend to prefer to do larger deals. They like putting their capital to work in large volumes. And for them, it's more bang for the buck, right? You know, they have with the same size team, they can put more dollars out the door with larger deals. But for these preferred equity investors, they may have an appetite for smaller check sizes and therefore smaller projects, smaller developers can get their attention. And I guess I would add that, you know, one of the constraints that historically has plagued or been a problem for smaller developers is they may not have a strong balance sheet. And tax equity investors historically have looked to do deals with sponsors who can have the credit worthiness to stand behind indemnity obligations. And so what we've seen in the market over the last, 2 to 3 years is that the tax insurance market has really grown quite a bit. And so these tax insurance products can be a very effective enhancement to the credit quality of a sponsor that may not have as strong a balance sheet as would be needed to attract tax equity. So that has been another development that has helped the smaller or the newer developers and project owners in the U.S.
And you mentioned that this is already a rapidly growing market. I think you laid out pretty well, you know, how strong the growth drivers are with this influx of tax credit money from the Inflation Reduction Act. With the finalization of the rules for tax credit transferability just recently coming through, does that affect the market going forward, do you think? Or was the momentum behind the market kind of baked in from the proposed rules last year?
I don't think that the final rules had anything that was a big surprise to the market. And based on my own experience, I'm not aware of any participants in the market who were holding off or delaying closing a transaction to wait for the results of the final rules. I wouldn't expect any material impact of the final rules, either positive or negative, just because, you know, we were seeing plenty of deals get done and no one was voicing any concerns about what would be in those final rules, and there were no surprises.
And going back to what you were saying earlier about traditionally these tax credits really only being available for solar and wind, and a major change coming through the IRA in the variety of projects that are eligible for tax credits. It sounds like so far, wind and solar projects have accounted for the majority of these tax credit transfer transactions. With the availability of credits for emerging markets beginning to get established, can you talk a little bit about how those markets are evolving and what you're seeing there?
Yes, sure. I think that wind, solar, and I would add standalone battery storage to that mix as well. These three technologies have been more prevalent in the market for tax credit transactions, whether tax equity or transferability. But I'd say that's really because two reasons. One, there are just a lot more wind and solar and battery storage projects that are being built right now than there are for some of the more emerging technologies. And so there's more opportunity to get a deal done. And then the second reason is, you know, naturally, any technology that is emerging is inherently newer, and people look at it, potential investors may look at it as being more risky, or at least less well understood, less well established. And so it may take some time for the market to figure out how, you know, what are the challenges associated with that particular technology, and how do you mitigate those challenges? You know, are there certain structures you can use? Are there certain due diligence points that need to be hit upon? You know, it could take some time for those technologies to really hit their stride, but we're already seeing deals getting done. It's just, it's a little slower start for some of the newer technologies. So for example, we've seen renewable natural gas deals get done with transferability. We're working on carbon capture deals. We saw one get announced a few weeks ago. So those technologies are certainly, they're progressing, and they will become very big consumers of, or sellers of the tax credits in the next couple of years.
That will be very interesting to watch for. Lastly, I wonder if you can share with us what market or regulatory developments you'll be watching for in this space as you advise clients in the renewable energy sector.
The one that tends to come up most often in my discussions with clients and counterparties is just, this is an election year. And so the presidential election, the congressional elections that occur later this year, you know, what impact will that have on the energy sector, the renewable energy sector? And, you know, there's some concern that, you know, there could be partial or more repeal, you know, parts or all of the Inflation Reduction Act. That's a question we get quite a bit. I suppose that, you know, no one can see the future, of course, but we think that's a relatively low likelihood that there's any material change to the Inflation Reduction Act. We see the IRA as benefiting projects and owners that are located, you know, across the country, including in red states. And so it would be, I think politicians would be careful about enacting any kind of legislation that could negatively impact those projects and those project owners. It's a fairly low likelihood that we see anything material happening there. To add to that point, in addition to the Inflation Reduction Act, there's an awful lot of support for the renewable energy space, even outside of the federal government. There's a lot of state policies that are in place. There's a lot of private companies have ESG mandates that they're striving to deliver on to the promises that they've made to their stakeholders. So even in the face of a change to the Inflation Reduction Act, which we think is a low probability, we think that there is a very strong future for renewable energy growth in the U.S. And then I guess I'd just say one other thing that we're looking at is Basel III regulations, which could increase the capital requirements for large banks for tax equity investments from large banks. If those proposals were to become law, then it would become essentially prohibitively expensive for large banks to provide tax equity product. If that were to occur, and I think the industry is confident that there will be a fix to those proposals, but if it were to occur, we would see a shift away from tax equity partnerships from large banks and much more deal flow getting done through a straight transferability and with, you know, alternative providers than the traditional tax equity bank. So smaller banks or other non-financial companies who can still provide the tax equity product and wouldn't be subject to the stringent capital requirements.
Well, yeah, we're certainly watching closely for a resolution on Basel III, and I'm sure many of our listeners are going to be joining you and me in watching closely for the election outcomes this November. Gary Durden, thank you so much for joining us. It was great talking with you about all of these issues. I appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. This was a real pleasure.
Thanks a lot. It was great having you on. That's all the time we have for this episode of Crossroads, the Infrastructure Podcast. Don't forget to follow us, rate us, and review the show on the podcast application of your choice. While you're at it, tell a few friends about us as well. I'm Chuck Stanley. Thanks for listening.